This is chapter 19 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smiley, and this is entitled A Day on Magus Moor. I've been to Magus Moor on a number of occasions. It's a solemn place where men were put to death for a crime they did not commit. James Sharp has fallen for some time out of our story, but through all the 12 years of Lauderdale's administration, he had been fighting busily his evil fight. The statesman, determined to suffer no plotters against his individual ascendancy, had humbled the prelate's pride when he began his own reign. Sharp's submission was abject. With some verbal protests for the sake of shielding himself among his episcopal brethren, he even helped Lauderdale to pass the Act of Supremacy, by which the clogs laid upon the king were knocked off. And His Majesty was endowed with absolute control over all ecclesiastical persons and meetings and matters. Poor lines in the Act, Sharp asserted at the outset, were more comprehensive than 100 and odd sheets of King Henry VIII. Yet when the Commissioner and he had a sound bout and I dealt freely with him, all his scruples vanished into thin air, and he riveted the chains round the wrists and ankles of his church. The Bishop of Ross would have fought for some small limitation of this all-embracing royal prerogative. But His Grace of St. Andrews, Sharp, snapped him up and said how foolish such a jealousy would be. He could always be relied on to second the plans of those who showed themselves possessed of sufficient power, and with whom it was hazardous for his comfort and prosperity to quarrel. No doubt they had perpetually to watch him, although they used his crafty diplomacy in their own interest. He was so apt to lift his head overweeningly. St. Andrews brags mightily, "The Earl of Kincardine wrote in the July of 1671, and even grows insolent, you know, cajoling loose of him, and that he is never right but when he is kept under." But a little astute management would sober his arrogance and would transmute him once more into a serviceable tool. Nobody detested the conventicles with such virulence or meted out such punishment to the men and women who frequented them. Most of all, there were at these rendezvous, one of the members of the Privy Council said, catched violent colds insomuch as they may be tried and found out by coughing. Some pity might have been extended to those for whom the road of the cross was thus thorny and steep, but James Sharp had none. In the spring of 1679, a year after the Highlanders had left the West, he brought before his fellow councillors the draft of a new edict, more deadly even than those which had been formerly devised. It gave liberty to kill any man who went armed to or from a meeting in the fields. No trial was necessary. The meanest officer who wore the king's uniform might shoot the suspected person on the spot. This was the calumniation of the archbishop's endeavours to stifle the Presbyterianism which he had once professed. But before he received the sovereign's consent, his race was run and he had met with terrible death. Before now there had been warnings given him of the burning hatred engendered by his presence. Back in 1668, James Mitchell, a man whose brain was touched with madness, had tried to assassinate him in the streets of Edinburgh. For 6 years the would-be murderer escaped, but at the end of that time Sharp recognised him one day and had him apprehended and led before the Privy Council. The council, knowing that he was scarcely responsible for his actions, persuaded him to confess the crime under a solemn promise that his life should be spared. He was sent to the Bass Rock, a terrible prison in the Firth of Forth. But if the poor man reckoned himself safe from the scaffold because of the explicit stipulation made to him, he had not fathomed the unrighteousness of his judges. In 1678, 10 winters after he fired his shot into the primate's coach, he was haled before the Justiciary Court. It seems incredible, but it is true, that the Earl of Rothes, who was Lord High Chancellor of Scotland, Charles Maitland of Hatton, who was Lord Treasurer Deputy, the Duke of Lauderdale and the Archbishop of St. Andrews himself, one after another, entered the witness box and swore that no promise of pardon had ever been given by the Privy Council. It did not matter that a copy was instantly produced by Mitchell's advocate. Mere copies of documents are without legal value, and the council's register was itself deliberately withheld. Even Lauderdale had his compunctions about the iniquitous transaction, and would have been content to see the prisoner consigned again to the dungeon on the Bass. It was Sharp who showed no relenting. he meant that at long length the capital sentence should be inflicted, and James Mitchell, in the mocking language of the day, was sent to glorify God at the grass market, in other words, to be put to death. 16 months after his execution, the archbishop was face to face with his own doom. Predictions of it, if some of the covenanting writers may be credited, had gone to him in advance, or some forerunners of the awesome event. John Wellwood, whom God took in youth from the evil to come, preached one Sabbath at Bolter Hall in the parish of Forgan, not far from St. Andrews. His text was that levelling word of St. Paul, "Not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called," and he bade Christ's people, who were in stations of distinction, rejoice in the initial M, for what had befallen them if the apostle had said not any? In the congregation he saw a lad wearing the archbishop's livery, a servant from his grace's palace. Calling him, when the sermon was ended, he commanded him to carry a grievous message to his master. "Tell him from me that his wicked life is now near an end, and that his death shall be sudden, surprising, and bloody." The young man went home, and being questioned the evening where he had been, announced the preacher's augury of terror. His lord made sport of it, but James Sharp's wife, poor lady, was not disposed to be merry. "I hear," she said, "that these men's words are not vain words." And thus the premonitory shadows, harbingers of dread, had fallen across his path. Now Sharp was on the eve of starting from Edinburgh for London, that he might secure Charles's signature to his new law against the conventicles. First, however, he went northward to St. Andrews. It was Friday, the 2nd of May, 1679. He rode in his carriage of state, drawn by 6 horses. With him was his eldest daughter, and he had an escort of 4 servants. Having crossed the Forth, he travelled as far as Kennaway, some 20 miles from his destination, where he spent the night. On the morning of the 3rd, about 9 o'clock, he left the house of his host, Captain Seaton. 12 miles on, he came to the manse of Ceres, where he smoked a pipe with the episcopal incumbent. Meantime, he sent one of the 4 servants with his salutations to Lord Crawford, whose mansion was near at hand. We must leave him in Ceres for a few moments, that we may learn what has been transpiring at no great distance. On the Friday evening, 13 men had met on one of the 5 Shamores to carry out a scheme which they had been discussing for some weeks. One of the 13 was dismissed, the rest not being clear that they could admit him to their confidence. The 12 who remained were David Haxton of Rathillet, John Balfour of Kinloch, better known by the designation of Burley, James Russell in Kettle, George Fleming, 2 Hendersons, Andrew and Alexander, William Daniel, 3 Balfours, James, Alexander and George, Thomas Ness and Andrew Gillen, a handloom weaver who had already suffered for his stubborn refusal to listen to the curates in Dundee, and who 9 years after this memorable Maytime was to be hanged at the cross of Edinburgh. What was their scheme? It was to chastise William Carmichael, a drunken and bankrupt magistrate whom Sharp had appointed Sheriff Deputy of Fife, and who had gleaned a harvest of obloquy by his brutal energy in putting into force the statutes against the Covenanters. It is not certain that they intended to kill Carmichael. Probably they would be satisfied if they succeeded in frightening him from the district. That night they went to Robert Black's in Baldini, who, being a prudent and wary man, had absented himself from his own homestead, leaving his guests in possession. They slept in the barn, having first sent one of their number to try and discover Carmichael's whereabouts. He returned from Cooper about 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, with the information that the sheriff, along with 3 or 4 friends, was to spend the day in hunting. At once they prepared themselves for the pursuit. But one mishap followed another. First, Rathillet's horse stumbled, and when it had recovered its footing, took fright and fled, and time was lost in recapturing the nervous animal. Then Russell and one of the Hendersons, and Fleming and George Balfour, catching sight of a raider not far off, and hoping that this was the man of whom they were in search, chased him for miles, only to find to their mortification that he was an innocuous laird of their own acquaintance. By and by, one of the band reported that he had seen Carmichael hastening to Cooper with all speed, some hint having reached him of the risks by which he was beset. God, they began to conclude, had remarkably kept them back and him out of their hand. Wearied and chagrined, they gathered themselves about midday at a part of the moor close to Ceres, all of them except James and Alexander Balfour and Thomas Ness, who had turned their horses' heads homeward. Here they halted and stood talking before they said their farewells and separated on their various roads. But just then a farm boy from Baldini came running to them. He gave them the startling news that the Archbishop's carriage would pass in a few minutes. They were thunderstruck. They had planned the castigation of a subordinate. Could it be that God was surrendering to them the prime author of their troubles? Burley said so in as many words. Burley, the Jehu of the Covenant. A little man, squint-eyed and of a very fierce aspect, and Russell, afterwards one of the most irreconcilable of the hillmen, was equally convinced. Having more than ordinary outlettings of the spirit for a fortnight together at Leslie, he had felt it borne in upon him that the Lord would employ him in some piece of service, and that there would be some great man who was an enemy to the Kirk of God cut off. And he could not be quit of the thoughts of Nero, and asked where he could find that scripture, for he could not get it. A somewhat nebulous revelation of the will of heaven, one is tempted to think. But his comrades listened approvingly. They mounted their horses and moved in the direction which the carriage must take. Again, for an instant, they paused to select their commander. With one consent, David Haxton was chosen, a man of fearlessness, of principle, of honour, of compassion too, although he was strictest of the strict. But he declined the responsibility. "The Lord is my witness," he said, "that I am willing to venture all I have for the cause of Christ, yet I dare not lead you on this act to this action, for there is a known private quarrel betwixt the bishop and me, so that what I should do would be imputed to my personal revenge and would mar my testimony. But as you are determined to go forward, I will not leave you." When Rathillet refused, Burley cried in loud tones as he spurred on his horse, "Gentlemen, follow me." He at least was without scruples, without questions, without visitations of regret. The carriage had gained the rising ground at Magus Moor, and now for the first time its coachman saw the men on horseback. Sharp himself saw them. "Drive, drive," he shouted in an access of terror, for whether he remembered John Way would or no, ever since Mitchell's attack he had been dogged by fears of violent death. The carriage bounded on, but Russell, who was ahead of his companions, came up with it, firing in at the window, and he exclaimed, "Judas be taken." The others were but a few seconds behind. Some of them held the servants, and severing the traces, let the horses go free. Then Russell went to the door. "Come out," they commanded, for they were anxious that Isabel Sharp should receive no harm. Again and again the old man refused, and Fleming and George Balfour shot at him seated within, and another of the group thrust at him with a sword. Strangely enough, amid such throngs of dangers, he was not wounded, but they believed him killed, and would have remounted and ridden off, but the prelate's distracted daughter was heard sobbing, "There's life yet." It was a sorrowful and fatal indiscretion. Once again the remorseless men, with the single exception of Rathillet, gathered round her father. They found that he was safe and whole. Burley told him their purpose, to slay him, not from personal malice, but because he had shed like water the blood of the saints. "Gentlemen, gentlemen, save my life," he begged, still from within the carriage, "and I will see to the saving of yours." But the sole answer he had was the stern one that nothing could shake their resolution, for they were spokesmen and swordsmen of God that day. Then he offered them money. "Thy money perish with thee," they retorted impatiently. As he continued to crouch within the shelter of the carriage, they fired again, and one of them stabbed him. He was wounded now, but not mortally. Trembling, he came out at last. They urged him to devote his last moments to prayer, but he would only pray to his assailants to have pity. Soon he caught sight of Haxton, standing at a distance, with his cloak about his mouth, all the time on horseback, standing, revolving his case of conscience, a figure which fascinated Robert Louis Stevenson. He crept on hand and foot towards him. "Sir," he besought him, "you are a gentleman, you will protect me." But Haxton, although he had his doubts, could not interfere. "I shall lay no hand upon you," was all that he said. Meanwhile, the others, unable to induce their victim to pray, were growing tired. They fired simultaneously. Perhaps in their excitement they did not take proper aim, for Sharp was still alive. Wild thoughts of sorcery seized them. Satan, they fancied, had rendered his servant proof against their bullets. Nothing but cold steel would accomplish their end. Their swords were drawn, and he saw the blades gleam in the sun, and knew at length that his fate was sealed. He was not a brave man. He abandoned himself to despair. His daughter, saddest of all the participants in the frightful scene, sprang desperately between her father and the Avengers of Blood. Haxton could not remain longer at a distance. Hurrying to his friends, he entreated them to spare these grey hairs. But daughter and intercessor were both too late. The swords, which deal death, were plunged into the body of the man who, for 20 years, had striven with might and main to destroy the Church of Scotland. They took nothing from him but his tobacco box and Bible and a few papers. With these they went to a barn nearby. Upon the opening of his tobacco box, a living humming bee flew out. This either Rathillet or Balfour called his familiar. They believed he was a spiritist, and they thought this was his familiar spirit, but he probably had a bee in his carriage that he caught. And some in the company, not understanding the term, they explained it to be a devil. In the box were a pair of pistol ball pairings of nails, some worsted or silk, and some say a paper with some characters, but that is uncertain. The odour of wizardry hung about the miserable archbishop to the close. "Go," James Russell said to the servants when all was over, "go take up your priest." History repeats itself. 23 years later, in July 1702, a party of 50 men met in the wood of Altefage in southeastern France, a score carrying fowling pieces, the others armed with scythes and axes. They were Camisards, and their leaders were the prophets Pierre Segur and Salomon Couder and Abraham Mazel. After a harangue from Segur and a blessing in the name of the Lord of Hosts, they started their march at sunset through the forest and across the wasteland to the little town of Pont de Montvert. It was where their arch-enemy, the Abbé du Chayla, had his home. They burst open his doors and loosed their fellow Huguenots lying in the cellars with stiff and swollen limbs, and fired the house. De Chayla, twisting some sheets into a rope, attempted to escape to the garden, but falling in the descent, he broke his thigh. He crept painfully to the concealment of a hedge, but the blaze disclosed him crouching in his thicket. "Ah, here thou art," Seguier cried, "the persecutor of the enfants de Dieu. The spirit wills that thou shouldst die." He dealt him the first blow, and afterwards the others struck him one by one. "Take this for thy father broken on the wheel," one said. "For my father broken on the wheel," one said, "and a second, and this for my brother sent to the galleys, and a third, and this for my mother dead of a bleeding heart, and the fourth, a fifth, a sixth, and these for our friends imprisoned, exiled, beggared." He received the cure declared, who buried him. 52 wounds, 24 of which were mortal. And all that night, the Camisards on their knees beside the dead body sang the psalms of Marot and Beza, the grim chant mingling with the sound of the flames and the rush of the torrents close by. What judgment shall we pass on the tragedies of Pont de Montvert and Megasmore? Infamous as Du Chayla and James Sharp were, this must be our verdict. The deeds were foully done. Sharp's character was despicable. His presence was a menace and a blight. But these facts do not excuse his murder. There are, of course, elements of extenuation. The act, unlike that of Seguier and Cordec and Mazel, was unpremeditated, committed by those who had come out to scare an inferior antagonist, and who had not a thought when they started of dealing with their chief enemy. It was condemned soon and utterly by the responsible leaders in the army of the Covenant. The captain of the band, moreover, that ferocious and iron-hearted John Balfour of Burley, was not a religious man. He was an enthusiast whose enthusiasm darkened into the bigotry of the fanatic. But he showed no sign of godliness, and even before his sanguinary, 3rd of May, he was kept back from sitting down at the sacramental table. His was not a nature sensitive to the highest and holiest things. In Dr. Walter Smith's verses, we hear him speak in his own tongue. "I killed the archbishop while Haxton stood by, and he was as much in the deed as I. But for they had a quarrel, his mind was not clear, our nice punctilious cavalier. Oh, we must not sully the end we seek with a personal grudge or a private pique. So we stand aside in the noonday sun like a stern old Roman and see the deed done. Was he better than I with my dirk to the hilt? In the old man's heart, when his blood was spilt, he had scruples, forsooth, and the priest's head was grey, and he did not the deed, nor yet said it nay. Bah, give me a conscience that rules with a will, or one that can hold its peace and be still. but neither the Lord nor the devil will care for your conscience that scruples splits on a hair. It is an accurate portrait of one whose cooperation was no blessing to the covenanters, but a weakness and a reproach. Yes, there are extenuations, but the old word is the right word. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Now, I began reading this by saying that those who were hung on Magus Moore weren't responsible. I'm thinking about the aftermath here. I didn't realise that this was only going to deal with the death of Archbishop Sharp and not the aftermath. We'll come to that. After the Archbishop Sharp's death, you could be asked by anybody in the street, was the death of Archbishop Sharp murder? And failure to answer yes could have you killed on the spot. We look back on former generations and judge them according to the values of our own generation. But I think that Smiley has actually accurately interpreted the killing of Archbishop Sharp, wicked man that he was.